In this part of the program, we'll spend our time talking about movies, and we're happy to have back with us once again David Desser. He's professor of cinema studies at University of Illinois. In fact, he is director of the Unit for Cinema Studies and has off and on over the years been with us many times to talk about movies. And his particular area of interest, his academic interest, is in the cinema of Asia, particularly East Asia, and he's written about Japanese film and filmmakers and Chinese film and filmmakers. And recently I know he started to become more interested in Indian film. And we've talked a little bit about that when he's been here before in the program. And whatever questions you might have, we've talked about history of cinema. We've talked a little bit about the movie business and how it is that movies are made. We have talked about movies that are now available on screens around the country. I'm sure he'll maybe have a couple things to say about the upcoming summer blockbuster season. And if you have questions, you can call. One of the things I've encouraged people to do in the past is to tell us about the movies that they have seen. If there's something that you've seen recently you thought was very good and you'd like to recommend, you may do that. Also, if you've seen something recently you thought was just awful and you'd like to say, don't go see this movie, and tell us why, you could do that as well. In any and all that is welcome. Movie talk is welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, good to have you here once again.
My pleasure, as usual.
One of the things, actually, I was kind of noodling around here, and I was looking at one of the mazillion websites that have to do with movies. And I was looking here, actually, at a bit about this recent film about the Crusades that has just opened up Kingdom of Heaven. And the thing that caught my eye about it was it talked about some of the box office that the movie had done and the fact that while people were, I guess, a little bit disappointed in how much money it made domestically, it's done very well overseas. And in fact, it opened in 97 different territories. Only Japan and China were not in on the worldwide release. And it was the top attraction in all the major markets. In Germany, it did $7 million. Spain, 5.2, 4.8 in the UK, 4 million in South Korea, 2.8 million in Mexico, 2.2 million in Russia. And the thing that it made me start thinking about, not so much about this particular movie, but was nowadays in Hollywood, when they make movies, how much they think about the international market.
Absolutely. That is an excellent question. And when you look at box office now, it's very interesting to see that there might be, if every American film, of course, you know, the rest of the world is much bigger than the U.S., if you think about it that way. But also the dollar, you know, they don't have so much money elsewhere. But the overseas box office is crucial, absolutely crucial. It used to be that they would say, well, we would do a third of our business overseas and two-thirds in North America, you know, U.S. and Canada. Then it became about 50-50. But now there's any number of films that do much better overseas. And my favorite example, really, I hadn't heard about The Kingdom of Heaven doing so well. All the news has been how poorly it did in the U.S. But the thing that really, really impressed me was that Woody Allen's film, which kind of came and went and got no critical attention and did, I think, total in the U.S. what Kingdom of Heaven did over the weekend, did about four times the business overseas that it did in the U.S. So that Woody Allen has, and of course, as you know, the cliche, the French love him.
Yes.
But in point of fact, it did very well. So if people say, well, how does Woody Allen keep making movies that don't make any money? One, they don't cost that much, but he actually is quite respected overseas, and they do pretty well. But the standard thing for Hollywood is ever-increasing budgets and ever-simpler scripts or stories, although I think Kingdom of Heaven is probably an exception to that rule. But the blockbuster syndrome that maybe grown-ups in the U.S. begin to despair is really the key to overseas. And that's just the way it has been for a few years. And it's the rare movie. There's some movies that don't play overseas, and I always find it interesting. So like a big hit in the U.S. like Dodgeball has very little cachet overseas. It doesn't mean that much. So movies that seem to be quintessentially or particularly oddly American, unsurprisingly, don't do as well overseas. Or sometimes they barely even open overseas. And my favorite example is you look at one of the most successful movies ever made was Forrest Gump. And Forrest Gump has virtually no box office overseas.
Huh.
I don't know, you know, if they didn't release it or if just nobody went to see it or if it's maybe just not at the point where movies weren't being tracked so well overseas. But that's a really good example, I think, of an all-American movie that just doesn't do as well.
Well, that's really interesting that, having said that, that the Woody Allen movie would have done so well, because I guess it was my understanding that American movies that do well overseas are big action movies that don't have a lot of dialogue, where
that's
it's
right.
pretty easy to understand what's going on. A Woody Allen movie, I would think, would be so dialogue heavy that it would be difficult to make that transition, and you'd have to have fairly extensive subtitles for people. Either that, or I guess you could dub it.
Some places, actually, you'd be surprised. In France, they'll often have about half the number of copies will be dubbed and half will be subtitled. A place like Germany, as sophisticated as they are, tends to favor dubbing. But what we're talking about is not that it did $200 million. It's that overall it did better than it did in the U.S. And there I would say it's because overseas audiences, again, there's a lot of them, but also you can find what I like to think of as cineast culture, that there's audiences that are very sophisticated that will go to see movies that are a little bit different. You know, what we think of as art films or foreign films play much better in other places. So you've got to be sure that in England and in France and in Germany and in Japan and in, you know, probably South Korea, maybe Italy, I haven't tracked the individually, just overall I know. So I think cineast audiences are big enough to take a moderately budgeted movie and make it do pretty well, which is obviously the case since that movie did I thought surprisingly well overseas.
Well, and certainly here in the United States there is that audience. Those are the people who go to the art theater or who are interested in who will watch foreign language films or independent films, smaller films. But it sounds like, is that you think that's fewer? There are fewer of those people within the American movie-going body than there are in France or Germany or Britain or Italy?
Well, I think, what's the word? Uh-oh. Per capita, I would say there are fewer. But since the U.S. has a population of 300 million and Italy and France have half, you know, obviously not the numbers. But I would also say that in a particular film like Woody Allen's latest, it wasn't marketed as an art film and it didn't play the art world. And so it died at the multiplex. And so you have to build word of mouth in different ways. And in some ways it did respectably for a Woody Allen movie who hasn't had a hit in a decade. So for Woody Allen, it didn't do that badly, but even Will Ferrell couldn't make the big audience numbers. But that might have been the case where it opened wrongly or, you know, it's hard to say. It's just I don't think that it was marketed as an art movie and didn't have time to build as an art movie does, right? If you go into multiplex, you have basically a week, and then they sort of don't care about you anymore.
Yeah.
Whereas an art film, you know, you can open it in 12 cities, 15 cities, let it build, you know, by the 2 months, 3 months go by. And you might have done the same box office, but then it might have been this good for an art movie, bad for a mainstream movie. It's hard to say, but I do think that cineast culture overseas, or at least overseas, you go to any major city in the world, and you'll find a lot of foreign films playing. Whereas in the U.S., you'll only go to, you know, you really have to go to New York and in L.A. to see a handful of foreign films, and they just do big business overseas.
And if you're lucky, depending on where you live, there might be one place that you could go. For in Champaign, Urbana, we're very fortunate; we have the art. But even in big cities like Chicago, I don't really think there are all that many places that show.
There aren't all that many. I would say, you know, 20 years ago, it was worse. I actually think things are better. So don't get me wrong. I'm not here decrying the, you know, the pitifulness of the American public. It's actually was worse 20 years ago, and I do think most cities will have, you know, one, you know, mid-sized cities or, you know, an art multiplex in some medium-sized cities. But again, it's how you market it, what sort of box office expectations you have. You know, and again, for Hollywood, Woody Allen is a kind of anomaly. You know, they let him make his movies, they're okay, but really they're tracking, you know, it's what happens to Kingdom of Heaven is much more important than what happens to Melinda and Melinda.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, David Desser. He's professor of cinema studies. He is also director of the unit for cinema studies at the University of Illinois. And every once in a while is on the program here. We talk about movies. And your questions, your comments, your reviews are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is our Champaign-Urbana number. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller over in Indiana, our line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Two questions. One, I wondered if you could get into the marketing mode and talk about demographics and percentages and what the impact is of that on people who want to get their movies out. I mean, do they deliberately just write for a particular niche and all that kind of stuff? Mm-hmm. Then the second question deals with availability. I just purchased a paperback. It has all the RKO features from, 36 to something like to 1960 when the Republic, or when, you know, they went out of business.
Mm-hmm.
And a number of them, as I read the synopsis and saw some of the stars, I said, I'd really like to have that.
So, oh, yes.
So I went to, you know, I did all I could on the Internet, you know, started with Google, which is not really that helpful. But anyway, I couldn't find them, you know, and I'm just wondering if anybody in the back of his mind who controls, say, the Republic or RKO or whatever, you know, I see they're starting to bring out things on DVD, you know, entire, you know, TV shows and stuff from, from the 50s. None of them the ones I want, but you know, unfortunately, at least they're doing it, so I thought it might be a move that way.
Okay.
And I just sort of talk along that line also, you know, that sort of thing. Can one write a letter or put, you know, say one letter's worth 1,000 people or whatever, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
See if anything like that's down the chute. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Okay.
Let me do the second question first. And that is, if you pick the example of RKO, you pick a very good example to talk about why a lot of movies aren't on DVD. And I'll give you a great example. Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. Fairly famous.
I've heard of them.
You have? Okay.
Yes.
I was wondering. Their movies are not on, none of the RKO movies are on DVD. Now, that is probably the biggest single shame in all of film history. I mean, those are great movies. It has to do, most likely, with who owns the rights to those RKO films. And it's not only who owns the rights to the RKO films, but who owns the rights to bring them out on DVD. When rights were negotiated, in the old days, you had the rights to exhibit a film in the theater, because that's all there was. When television came in, you had to renegotiate who owns the rights to show them on television. Who owns the rights to distribute them to movie, to airplanes? Who owns the rights to show them on VHS? Who owns the rights to show them on DVD? And every time a new technology, so now, of course, what they do is we have the rights to distribute this theatrically in perpetuity throughout the galaxy in any such format as we deem fit. So it really is a matter of who owns the rights to show these. And, of course, RKO, when it was first bought by Howard Hughes, a man lately in the news, then it was the General Tire Company and the Republic Pictures got involved there. So it's a matter of, you know, who's gonna distribute them. Second of all, you notice that a lot of the studios have made available very few films before, say, 1933, 34. Because they don't think that there's that much of a market. It's not just a question of their being in black and white. You know, I think people have solved the question of colorization is dead for once and for all. But those early 30s, late 20s movies, yes, there's some, but they really are so uncommercial. There's just not a big enough market for a studio like 20th Century Fox or MGM to get involved. If you think about it, also, so many of the studios now have changed hands so many times, and they're really only a handful. And what they're really interested in is the ability to release a film that has the ancillary markets and that has the other kinds of markets. think, you know, obviously is not a great example, but an obvious example is Star Wars. I've seen Star Wars has ties with two different kind of foods, and there's a video game that's already out, and the novelization is already out. Well, you're not going to have a video game and a novelization and ancillary markets for a musical made in 1932.
So, flying down to Rio.
Flying down to Rio, the video game. Well, that would be good. Dance like Fred Astaire. So it's a question of, the twofold question is, who has the rights and how much market do they believe that there is? So that's really the question. I'm often surprised as to how many movies have come out. The other thing that you might look into for the caller is, a lot of movies came out on VHS. A lot, because it was, you know, somehow, not that it was cheaper, but it was easier, I suppose. And then, so if you went to something like eBay, you never know what movies you might find. Now, there might be dupes or, you know, quasi-legal, but I think a lot more stuff, I know for a fact that I met someone who was interested in the old serials of the 30s and 40s, and that stuff's on VHS, but I don't believe it ever came out on DVD. So that's the idea. Now, as for the first question, a niche. Movies are marketed, tested, plotted out from the time a script is bought. And from there on in, all the way through the time it's test screened, there's always an eye for who will buy this film, who will see this movie. And what can we do with this movie after the movie's over in terms of ancillary rights, et cetera, et cetera. But they always have to have, and they have to. I mean, you know, the average Hollywood movie now costs, you know, $100 million. But if you're talking about any kind of medium-budget movie, it's $50, $60 million. It's not an independent movie, which doesn't do that. But any Hollywood movie's got a huge investment. So they always have in the back of their mind, who will this appeal to? What rating can it have? One of the things that's most interesting is we find the majority of blockbusters are PG or PG-13. Not only PG-13, but they've been finding that PG movies have been doing extremely well. So there's been a decrease in R-rated movies. You know, in terms of the big giant movies really want to go for PG-13. Look at it this way. Alien versus Predator. This had to be the most bloody and gory movie you ever saw. It was PG-13. Which was a huge disappointment because I wanted to see the most bloody and gory movie there ever was, but it wasn't. So, of course, you know, the lower budget slasher movies, you know, like House of Wax that comes out every couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. But anything that has a substantial investment, they really are going to be careful. Should we do it R, PG-13, maybe PG? And, of course, the demographic that's most important is still what I like to call boys. And that's boys from 12 to about 40. Because, you know, boyhood gets longer and longer.
I know some over 50.
Indeed, there may be one talking to you now. Mm-hmm. So it's the thing. But the marketing department is brought in from the get-go. I mean, it's just incredible. I mean, it's been this way for a long time. Mm-hmm. But I suppose for any blockbuster, it really is the marketing more than anything else that determines how the movie will look and feel.
Okay. Well, I hope that gets the question of the caller. Others are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Our guest is David Desser. He's professor of cinema studies here at University of Illinois. Every once in a while, he's here. We talk about movies and the movie business.
Yes, I was thinking one more thing.
I'm sorry if I interrupted you.
No, no, you didn't. It just occurred to me.
Okay.
One of the reasons that we see the kind of blockbusters we see is the whole idea of pre-sold properties. You know, it's easy to market something that people know. And so, again, the old bugaboo of it's a sequel, mm-hmm. it's a remake, and it's based on, you know, a well-known property. So, again, here you have, in the summertime, you have, you know, Star Wars 3/6, and you have the remake of War of the Worlds. That's just a couple. You have a number of movies based on comic books. Mm-hmm. And you have a number of movies, unfortunately, based on television shows.
Mm-hmm.
And so sequels, remakes, and pre-sold properties, that especially those that appeal to your primary demographic. You know, what's happened, of course, is CGI effects. For years and years, you've occasionally seen, you know, movies and TV shows based on comic books. But if you remember, really the most successful of those overall were probably the animations. Now that you have CGI, the comic book, let's say the comic book genre has just gone wild. And there's apparently no stopping it because now you have the Fantastic Four coming out. So, and of course, Batman Begins. So that's just, you know, two right this summer. And, you know, there's others, the sort of comic book type movies. But those are obviously, you know, based on comic books. So the primary demographic and your pre-sold properties and your sequels and your remakes are also, the marketing department can get their hands on it. We know people like it because they liked it before.
And darn it, they're going to
like it
again.
So that's what happens.
All right. Well, let's talk with someone else. Here we have a caller in Terre Haute, and this is on our line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yeah.
Unforgiven by Clint Eastwood. That was critically acclaimed. Was it a box office smash, too? I can't remember. And then Billy Crudup was in a movie. I think it was Jesus' Son.
Mm-hmm.
Did that director ever go on to direct anything else?
That's a good question. I can't answer that offhand. I don't know. That was an independent movie, very well respected, but I don't remember. Unforgiven was not a smash, but it was a hit. And it was one of those movies that did pretty well beforehand, and then its Best Picture Award of the Academy Awards made it do good business. So it was a substantial hit, but certainly not a blockbuster.
One other question. Boogie Nights, that director, has he made any other films?
Oh, yes. He's made quite a few. Boogie Nights was an early film, but he's gone on to do a lot. Probably the best one is... what was the one with Tom Cruise that was so interesting? With the frogs falling from the sky.
With the frogs...
Magnolia. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Henry Frain.
So Magnolia, among others. But he's done, I would say that he's one of the Andersons. There's a bunch of people named Anderson. he's probably done 8 or so movies.
Was Big Fish one of his?
No, Big Fish was Tim Burton.
Tim Burton, okay.
Yeah, Tim Burton.
Okay.
But there's a couple of directors named Anderson. I think he's B.G. Anderson or anyway. But he's definitely done a handful. But Magnolia was one that I particularly liked.
Okay, thanks.
And just for your the director of Jesus' Son, a woman named Allison McLean, and now I'm here looking at the Internet Movie Database.
Oh, yes, always look there.
It lists one other movie since then, a film called Persons of Interest that came out last year. And
don't know it.
It doesn't really... It's a documentary. It's a documentary concerning the detention of Muslim Americans in the wake of 9/11. So it's a non-fiction movie.
So it's a documentary.
It's a documentary. So other than that...
I actually had heard of that one, but yeah.
Other than that, she has not directed a film more recently than Jesus. And I actually saw it because I talked with, not this year, I think it was last year, it might be the year before, one of the people who produced the movie was here for the Roger Ebert Festival, and I got a chance to see the movie. I went out and rented it and talked with them. I thought it was a good film.
I agree.
Jesus' Son, you're talking about?
Yes.
I think thought it was very good.
Me too.
Yes, I thought Billy Crudup, it was a really nice performance.
I agree.
I think he did a nice job.
I agree.
Is Billy Crudup doing the advertisement now with the 7-Eleven or some store like that? Is that Billy Crudup?
I know the guy you mean. He looks kind of like him.
It's not
Bill. No.
Yeah, that's the MasterCard commercials, right?
It's a
they come in priceless. They want a Slurpee.
That's the MasterCard commercial. Priceless.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
That's right.
So that's not. Fortunately, Billy apparently gets better work than that.
Slightly. Although I don't know. Commercial work pays well.
Well, you know what? It pays. I guess if it pays the bills, that's okay.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right. Sure thing. We are at our midpoint here again. We're talking with Dave Desser. If you have questions, you can give us a call about movies. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Urbana. Line number 1. Hello.
Yeah, I was wondering if the professor had heard any gossip about somebody picking up the Marla Ruzicka story and making a movie out of that, because I think it'd be a pretty good one. And I was actually thinking John Sayles would be perfect for it, but I don't really know what's involved in and what would be involved in picking up a story like that. Maybe you could talk about that a bit. And because sales seems to be pretty much booked up for the next 2 or 3 years, according to IMDb. So,
yeah, they do list the upcoming. I don't know the specific name story that you mentioned.
Oh, that's the lady that the blonde that was used to be a kind of an activist, and she went over to Iraq and was helping people.
Oh, yes, I know now exactly who you mean. I know exactly who you mean. Yeah, that was a very sad story. Interesting. The rights for it depends. the amount of story in the public domain, so that you see Law and Order when they claim their stories are ripped from the headline, take just enough without having to pay the rights. So there is a kind of what we might think of as, you know, public domain or in the public eye. When you base a story on an actual person, you really have to pay them for the rights to their story.
But she's dead.
Right. Well, then, but she would have a family.
Right. So it's the family they'd have to negotiate with?
Yeah, you'd have to negotiate and ask for how much. Now, you know, they might say it's fine or whatever, but you'd have to get permission. And the closer you know, if you use the real name, you certainly have to do that. And it's a little trickier than if it's a book or anything like that, where you have to buy the rights and negotiate with the copyright holder. But you do. You can't just tell anyone's story without permission. Although, to some extent, it's really a matter of public domain. So if I were to make a film about the Clinton impeachment hearings, it might be that I wouldn't have to negotiate any rights. But I think for the Marla Russica story, you would definitely have to.
And I take it, since you didn't have the name at the at your fingertips, you haven't heard of anybody trying to get that story.
I wouldn't be surprised. I hadn't, but I wouldn't be surprised, and it wouldn't surprise me if it were actually done fairly quickly on television.
On television.
Yeah, they do those kind of things all the time on television, especially with so many cable channels now. There's a real rush to get product, and they can do it much quicker, and they can do it much cheaper. And
yeah, but they would also do it on a very washed out, ineffectual way, because one of the main points of that woman's life was that, here she was probably doing 10 times what, say, for example, the Bush daughters have ever done in their life. And yet her status and the privileges accorded to her were minimal.
No, I couldn't agree with you more. The other thing, of course, nowadays there's so many really good documentaries that someone might be smart and do a documentary on the subject and not fictionalize it. But that's how it would have to be done. You know, someone has to buy the rights. But it wouldn't surprise me if it would show up as you say, a washed out.
TV. Okay, thanks.
All right, thanks for the call. Well, again, questions, comments are welcome. We're talking about movies this morning with David Desser. He's director of the Unit for Cinema Studies at University of Illinois, and occasionally he's here on the show. We just do this, talk a little bit about the business, about movies, how they are made and sold, and to give people the opportunity to ask questions, make comments, tell us about what they've been seeing. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Something that just occurred to me when we were talking earlier about the fact that in Europe, there certainly are groups of people who are really interested in movies and like to see interesting different movies, movies that were made in different countries and so forth. I was wondering if you take an American movie, sort of a mid-budget, slightly offbeat American movie, one that was pretty successful. Say, take a movie like Sideways. Are people in Europe and France and Germany and Italy and places like that, would there be an interest in a movie like that?
In specific, my recollection of Sideways is that it didn't have any particular overseas market, but it depends on, of course, who's distributing it, and someone overseas has to pick it up. The answer there is it depends on the movie. I would say that smaller movies and bigger movies do better than medium movies overseas. And not positive why that is, but it may have to do with, it doesn't cost as much to market a small movie your big movie is going to be marketed, and it's that medium movie that you have to have. I mean, most American studios don't distribute overseas themselves. They're in partnership, or they'll sell their movie to an overseas distributor. And so just as you have to have someone pick up a movie to distribute, so too overseas, and it might be that those medium movies are tougher. But I could be wrong, but I remember looking occasionally, you know, read the box office to see how it's doing, and I think I saw that Sideways didn't do anything overseas. Though, again, it may not have been released, and maybe no one wanted it, or it may not just have gotten released yet. There's a lot of movies that take their time, though generally it's the other way around, where we get the movies 4 years after everyone else, but that may be the case. But I could be wrong about Sideways. I just think it didn't.
Well, that was just one that just...
I was thinking of
that kind of movie that sort of occurred to me as just as an example. You know?
Yeah. No, I think, as I say, I really would have to study it, but I would say the smaller or the bigger.
Yeah. Okay. And when I can understand, there's good reasons why that would be the case.
I think so.
So, okay. Well, let's talk with some more folks. Champagne, line number one is next. Hello.
Hi. I've been talking to some friends of mine in Los Angeles. And there seems to be a lot of buzz about this film called, I believe the title is, What the Bleep Do We Know? And I haven't seen it out here at all at any of the video stores. Have you heard anything about it?
I believe it's out, or it's coming soon.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it played. I remember Ebert reviewed it, and he hated it.
Oh, God.
But that may not, you know, but...
We don't always listen to the critics.
That's right. Oh, I think you should listen to the critics and then do what you want.
Exactly.
I have heard of it, and it's a kind of comedy / math comedy / metaphysical movie, and the critics were really divided.
Really?
But mostly I recall mainstream critics didn't like it.
Okay.
But if it's not out, it should be out very soon.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Well, thank you. To Danville, let's talk with someone here. Line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Great show. I wanted to get you to make a comment on all the recent movies the last few years that come out that are comic book related, mm-hmm. superhero movies, Spider-Man stuff. Obviously, a lot of them have done well in the past. The first couple Batman ones did well, but then as they went on, they seemed to get a little more campier and stuff. I was wondering, are we reached a peak with a lot of this? I know the new Batman one, they promised to go back. They're talking about a Superman one next year.
That's right.
Somewhat promising. I kind of had higher hopes for the Sin City movie, but from what I've read in the papers, it doesn't sound like they're doing so well.
No, they're not. Sin City is an interesting case because you talk about a comic book movie. It looks like a comic book as opposed to being adapted. And I actually, from what I hear of, you know, probably why Sin City didn't do as well, and that is it's violent. There was a movie that didn't get a PG. But I suspect it really is that it looks like a comic book. And over the course of 95, 100 minutes, that can get wearying.
So, and that's what they were really,
what they wanted to do,
trying to make it look like
a comic book. Yeah,
well,
they succeeded in doing that, but I think that's why it didn't do as well. I mean, if you're going to adapt something, you adapt it. You don't, in a sense, refilm it. But that's just my theory. It's probably very wearying. But it really, the comic book trend is not slowing down. And as I said before, it's really been enabled by ever-increasing CGI effects where, you know, everything is seamless. So if you see the trailer for Fantastic Four and you don't know what's animated and what's real, Captain and the End of the Universe, Captain whatever it was, there were no sets at all in that movie. The entire acting was done in front of a screen. So the effects are getting better and better. And the key really, I think, is to make a good movie. So people thought Spider-Man 2 was a good movie, and it did very well. People didn't think The Hulk was a good movie, and it didn't do very well. So I think part of it is going to be you're going to have to make good movies. And if you do, they'll do well.
Yeah, I think the year that Spider-Man 2 came out, I think all of the what they thought that, well, the sequels were generally not quite as good as the first ones, and it seemed like that year was the year that they were all proved wrong, that the sequels were as good, if not better. But I do notice, at least from what the like the very first Batman movie, which was, what was that, 89, I think it was now, which that seems like forever, that it just, the CGI has just improved so much.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Quite a bit, but I agree on the story, and that's what I'm hoping with the new one that's coming out, well, next month, because they're going more towards origin issues and trying to get back to the darker past like the first two Burton movies was.
Mm-hmm. No, I think if they make a good movie, I think the temptation is to camp it up a little bit, and that's always wrong. I think if they take it seriously and make a decent movie, it should work.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the comment. A friend of ours from downstairs here at WILTV, Dave Teal, was listening and heard the caller call in to ask about this movie, What the Blank Do We Know? And I'm here again. I'm on the Internet Movie Database, and I guess the official title uses those collection of things that you see in comics that stand in for obscenities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that this movie actually dated from last year, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
It was 2004. Yeah. And Dave Teal called in and said that he, in fact, had this morning been at a video place, or places where they had videos, and said that he actually saw it.
Yeah, I thought it was just out.
And you can, I guess, look for it in wherever it is you like to go and get your videos.
Someone was talking to me about it the other day, and I did recall that that's probably because it just came out on video.
All right.
Yeah, it was pretty much a failure commercially, but it doesn't mean you shouldn't see it, or it might be interesting.
Well, it does. It's not something that has a lot of big stars, isn't it? Not that that means anything in particular. It looks to me like Marlee Matlin is in it.
Yes,
she's
the
only person here that I, as I look down the cast list.
Well, it's an independent film. But someone did say it was the best film about higher mathematics they'd ever seen. The best math comedy they'd ever seen.
Best math comedy. Yeah. Well, that's something to be said, I guess. Plot summary says, it's a radical departure from convention. It demands a freedom of view and greatness of thought so far unknown.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
very good. Well, there, if people want to check it out.
You know, a movie like that tries to be odd. And when a movie tries to be odd and weird, it's a tricky thing. Sometimes a movie works. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it takes a while for people to catch on. But I think that's a movie that wished to start off as a cult movie, and that's very difficult to make that kind of balancing act between, you know, it's supposed to be funny and it's just bad.
Puts me in mind of David Lynch.
No, David Lynch, I think, is not supposed to be funny.
No, but he's as someone who sets out deliberately to make a movie that's weird.
That's true.
I've always felt that he just did stuff just for the sake of being weird.
I agree with
not
you.
Not that there.
There
was any reason for things, certain things. He just did it because it was weird.
Well, yes, but what if he thinks they're not weird? He said, what? That's a straightforward film?
There's nothing weird about that. What are you talking about? I wasn't trying to make a weird movie.
Actually, that's why his one movie that is sort of mainstream is called Straight Story, so that it's actually just a straight story.
I see.
I think to prove that he could do it.
All right. Let's talk with somebody else. We have someone in Whiteheath, line 3. Hello.
Hi. Well, now for something completely different. Recently, I saw the Oscar-nominated shorts collection at the Art Film, and I really liked it, and I do like shorts a lot. And it made me wonder, where do shorts get shown so that somebody can notice them? And how do you get financing to make a film that nobody ever sees? Where do they come from, anyway?
Yeah, it's a very good question. It used to be, I don't think they do it anymore, but it used to be that a short had to play for at least a week at a theater in Los Angeles to be eligible for an Academy Award, just like any other film did. But I think they've changed that. Where you can see shorts, for the most part, is at film festivals, especially at film festivals called short film festivals. And what happens is people raise the money in any which way they can, and they do it generally for two reasons. One, they hope their film will win a prize at a film festival. Maybe their film will get nominated for an Academy Award for a short film. And then maybe they'll get a chance. In the old days, I think it used to be that a short film was a way to move up to make a feature. But nowadays, people make features for so little money that I don't think that short filmmakers really use that as a route. Now you can make an independent film for, you know, certainly well under $500,000, and, you know, you have the whole Sundance Film Festival for that.
Well, for instance, there are no short film festivals at the University of Illinois.
No, but there are short film festivals in Michigan. There's short film festivals down in Carbondale. There are short film festivals, also regular film, so to speak. Ebert showed the Guy Madden short when he showed the Guy Madden feature. A lot of film festivals will program a short in front of a feature, though that's not as common as it used to be. But there are probably dozens of short film festivals. In a town like this, I think what you really need is a community of filmmakers. Actually, there is probably short film festivals at the University of, not at the University of Illinois, but in Champaign-Urbana. There actually are times when people do show shorts.
Oh, okay, thank you.
I think you'd have to look at the local free papers, the Hub and papers like that. But there is a magazine here called Microfilm that's published out of here, and they will have the Microfilm Festival. They used to do it sometimes at the Canopy Club. They sometimes use others. So actually, there are places. So in fact, but I think you have to really want to make movies just to make shorts, because it's very hard for mainstream audiences to see them. But okay. there are people who want to do it.
Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. To Chicago for our next caller here, line 4. Hello.
Yeah. Hi. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the availability of classics in Chicago and New York, if you're interested, where some of these films are shown and located and sold. Is that okay?
Sure.
Well, in Chicago, your best bet is to contact Facets Multimedia, mm-hmm. Which sells pictures from all over the world, mm-hmm. Classics, old ones, going back to the 20s and so on. And they also display them. I think they have one or two playhouses on their property.
Yes, they do. They have two theaters.
Yeah. There's a music box which shows classics. It's a neighborhood, well, it caters to the whole metropolitan area, but it's a small theater. Mm-hmm. Located in Chicago. There's the Doc Film Group in the University of Chicago. They show classics every day now, every night, and at a reasonable price, and they're really good stuff. International House at the University of Chicago also displays these films. There's Columbia College, which concentrates on the arts and radio and television. I don't know how good whether they provide classics and that sort of stuff, but you may contact them. They're located on Michigan Avenue in the South Loop. And, of course, Northwestern University. I don't know what they have. Now, if you're really interested in Asian films, Indian films, there's a concentration of Indians and Pakistanis up in the West Rogers Park area along the Vaughan Avenue. Scores and scores of stores which sell Asian films of all types. Going to New York, you've got the your best bet is to get hold of a copy of the New Yorker or the New York Times, the Thursday, Friday, or Saturday editions. Friday, Saturday, or Sunday editions. And, of course, they have things going on all the time. And also the museums in New York and the museums in Chicago have series of classics that they show. The Art Institute of Chicago and the Museum of Modern Art and so on. I think the Metropolitan Museum also in New York and a number of other places. Also, Roger Ebert, last time I looked, about 6 months ago, was running a course at the University of Chicago on movies, and he may be a good contact up there. I think that's about it.
Okay, yeah. And definitely we want to mention, and I know we've mentioned it before here on the program, is the place that the caller mentioned, that's Facets. And if you have internet access, they do have a website, and that's F-A-C-E-T-S. It's Facets, www.facets.org. And that's a place where you can buy tapes and DVDs. You can rent through them, and it is one of those places that you may be likely to, you'll be likely to find those things you cannot find. You may not be able to find at your local video rental store. That's a place for unusual films, foreign films. Yeah, you know,
Facets is great. Yeah. Another one that's very, very good is Movies Unlimited. But yeah, Facets.org is a great. Facets has been that way for years and years. I mean, they were in the VHS business, and they stuck. Then they moved to DVD, and they're just fantastic.
And it sounds like they are all kinds of they have many books about film and all kinds of stuff. If you're a movie person,
yeah, absolutely,
that's a place to go.
Absolutely right.
All right. Well, let's come back here to a caller in Champaign-Urbana in line number one. Hello.
Hi, comment on remakes. The DOA remake had a woman actively involved in detective work, and the original didn't. But Front Page had Jack Lemmon as a reporter. I think the original had a woman.
The one that had a woman was a remake of the original.
Oh, huh.
Which was James Cagney and Pat O'Brien.
Right. So, Failsafe on TV could have used more women and minorities. That was a made-for-TV movie.
Uh-huh.
Thanks.
Yeah. Well, and certainly, I mean, it happens a lot. Sometimes it's successful. Sometimes it's not. I just wonder what possessed the director that made them decide that this was the thing to do, remake a movie that was perfectly good the first time around.
No, there's interesting. Those brings up interesting ideas. You know, the Front Page is a very good one because it was a play. Mm-hmm. Then it was a movie with Cagney and James Cagney and Pat O'Brien. Then it was reimagined by Howard Hawks as His Girl Friday, when the reporter was a woman. Then it was done, you know, to take advantage of the popularity of Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau, who'd made a series of movies. Mm-hmm. But remakes can do interesting things. You know, what happened at the original DOA? The original DOA is a kind of classic, but it's very low budget, very minimal. In the days before everything seemed to be available on VHS or DVD, you know, maybe remaking it. As the caller rightly said, there's the woman in there that adds a little something. So if the remake is going to do something maybe that the original couldn't do or puts a new spin on it, or, you know, people just don't realize that it's a remake. So the recent Dennis Quaid Flight of the Phoenix, which I liked, Dennis Quaid was on my mind because he's in the remake of DOA. The recent Dennis Quaid remake of Flight of the Phoenix was pretty good. Now, of course, the original with Jimmy Stewart is fondly remembered, but, you know, how well remembered is it? Is it available on DVD? Will people watch older movies? It's a new generation. I'm often surprised at how, with so many movies available, youngsters, which is most of the world, youngsters don't see that many older movies. I mean, to them, anything before the 80s is an old movie. So if you're talking about movies from the 30s and 40s and 50s, it really takes, a special youngster who's really motivated to see a lot of these movies. So, in essence, it's new. I mean, the only remake that seemed really, really stupid right off the bat was when they remade Psycho, shot for shot.
Yes.
So there's some times where the idea is just really bad. But other times, you know, maybe it's not a... To me, the ones that are really bad, the remakes, are the TV shows. A TV show is by nature serialized and you build up. So what you're doing really in a TV show is you're kind of taking a premise or an idea and you're giving it a one-off thing, and they almost never work. And so it's really pointless. And, you know, the number of TV, inspired movies that really were pretty good is really minimal.
Yeah. This question just pops in my mind. Are we getting to the point now where DVD sales of television shows, that is television shows on DVD, are bigger than movies? Are we getting to that point, or are we past that point?
I don't believe so.
Oh, okay. I wonder, because it seems that it's something that we're seeing more and more and more of.
Yeah, I had never heard that. It is, of course, the case that DVD sales overall exceed the box office for movies overall. But I hadn't heard that TV shows. So when I buy Homicide Season 6 for $100, it sure feels like I'm spending a lot of money. But it's worth it.
Yeah. We're almost to the point where we have to finish. One thing that I sometimes ask is if you have any DVD picks, if you're going to rent something and you're looking for something that might have been good, you've missed up first time.
Well, let me give two. I have a few, but let me give two. Okay. A very interesting foreign film called Divine Intervention that was a co-production in a number of countries, including Palestine. But I was thinking that Ebert had showed at the Ebertfest Playtime, and the director of Divine Intervention was really inspired by Playtime. Hmm. So you don't see that many comedies from the Palestinian territories. And the other thing I must recommend is the new and expanded The Big Red One, 47 minutes longer than it was, plus a second disc of optional extras, but a 47 minutes longer of Sam Fuller's World War II classic with Lee Marvin and Mark Hamill.
When he was just a
wee kid. So The Big Red One, I always thought The Big Red One was a great film, and now 47 minutes longer, it's that much better.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. It's always fun. David Desser, he's director of the Unit for Cinema Studies at University of Illinois, and occasionally he's here, and we talk about movies.